Escuelas Oficiales de Idiomas de la Comunidad de Madrid. Pruebas de certificación. Comprensión oral. Inglés. Certificado de nivel C1. Convocatoria de abril de 2016.
This test has 3 tasks. Task 1. You will hear part of a program. Read through the sentences before listening. According to what you hear, write the option A, B or C, which best completes them, in the corresponding white box. Sentence 0 has been completed as an example. Now, read the sentences.
I've long believed that one of the most important things we need to be teaching our kids in school is music and art. And here's why. An education system that simply just transfers data from one brain to another is not an education system. It's a data download. We need real education. Joining me now is a person who understands something about it and probably the most gifted communicator on earth when it comes to helping to explain the value of creativity. Sir Ken Robinson, the author of the brand new book that I hope you'll read called The Element. Sir Ken Robinson joins me here today. Sir Ken, it's great to have you here. What a pleasure. Now, this book is a fascinating book into why creativity has an important impact on the economy.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me, in a time when people are losing their jobs, worried about the economy, why on earth should we be even discussing creativity and things of that nature?
Well, Mike, the world is moving so quickly now. Technology is changing everything. Populations are increasing. There's more competition. Globalization is taking away all the basic fundamentals of the success of the American economy hitherto. And truthfully, a nation that doesn't innovate will simply fall behind. And innovating in the 21st century means developing everybody's talents. It's a totally different game now.
Different than the old days of here. We need to learn these math tables and learn these scientific formulas.
Well, you need
formulas.
To learn those things too. This isn't to say that creativity means not learning things. It means learning things to a much higher level. But my big concern, really, and why I've written the book, is that in my experience, most people, most adults, have no idea what their real talents are. And their children don't know what their real talents are either. And I think one of the reasons for it is education. I give lots of stories in the book. You know, I'm from Liverpool.
Right.
And so are the Beatles, the popular music group.
You interviewed Paul McCartney for the book, in fact.
It's very funny you should mention.
I'm very jealous. Very jealous.
Well, Paul McCartney went to the school across the street from where I went to. I didn't know him then. But that school is now a school for performing arts. And I interviewed him for the book. And I asked him if he enjoyed music at school. And he said he hated it. In fact, he went through the whole of his education, and nobody thought he had any musical talent. Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
He does, doesn't he? They had, in the same music class at the same time, was George Harrison, the lead guitarist of, he said, popular music group, the Beatles. And nobody thought he had any talent either. So this one music teacher had half the Beatles in his class. and he missed it. Now, this is my point, really, that often talent is buried deep. And unless you look for it, unless you really give the encouragement and the conditions for it to flourish, you don't discover it. And the book really is about that. It's about how, personally, if people don't discover their true talents, they never, I think, live a life that has real purpose and meaning. And secondly, for the success of the American economy, the global economy, it makes sense now that we should have an education system that really looks deep for people's genuine talents.
We're talking about getting to double digits in unemployment, first mm-hmm. time perhaps since the Great Depression that's happened. That may happen this year. If a person's about to lose their job, what would your advice be to them in terms of starting another career and moving on from that?
I think no matter what age they are, they should start to think hard about the things that have always excited them, about the things where they feel comfortable, the things that make their imagination work. In my experience, most people have that. You know, there's a sense that there's something they would have done if they could have done it, something that really made them feel most comfortable. A lot of people in my experience, a lot of adults, live their lives doing work they don't enjoy much, doing things that don't really turn them on. And they do it because they feel they have to or because they just drifted in that direction. I know from your own story, I mean, you discovered music at school.
Yes.
Theatre. Didn't that help you become the person you are?
I would not be sitting here talking to you today had it not been for music and theatre and debate and those things. Those were the things that turned me on. And I think there are so many kids. The dropout rate now is 1 in 3 kids in America. 1 in 3 leave school. They don't even finish. And it's not because they're dumb. It's because they're bored.
Well, I think that's true. You know, can I ask you how old you are, Mike?
I'm 53.
I can't believe that. You know,
if I was female, I would have slapped you.
I'm okay by telling you that. But you're mentally slapping me. I can feel it. You know, well, you know, most people, I'm 59. No, I'm not, 58. I know I don't look that, but I live in Los Angeles. You know, I've had work done.
Yeah.
What can I tell you? But most people of my generation had their tonsils taken out. I don't know if you had your tonsils taken out.
Yes, I did.
May I ask the audience, how many of you had your tonsils taken out?
A lot of tonsilless people up here.
A lot of tonsilless people.
Yes.
When were you last asked that, by the way? It doesn't come up socially, does it? Your Deirdre, do you have your tonsils? It doesn't come up. I've asked rooms full of people, maybe 2,000 people of the boomers, have they had their tonsils taken out? In the 50s and 60s, people routinely had their tonsils removed.
Yes, they did.
When I was a kid, you couldn't afford to clear your throat in public, or somebody would pounce on you and take your tonsils out. And probably adenoids as well, Laura. You know, people had whole body parts removed, whimsically. And some people did it voluntarily for the ice cream. Now, the reason I'm saying this is that nowadays, if you ask a room full of teenagers if they've had their tonsils taken out, mostly they haven't. This is only done now in critical cases, and it used to be routine. Now, this generation doesn't suffer from the plague of tonsillectomies. It turned out to be a false epidemic. What this generation suffers from is a new false plague of ADHD. Now, don't you agree?
Yeah.
You know, now, don't mistake me. I'm not saying there's no such thing as ADHD. It's a genuine condition. Doctors agree on that. Some people need their tonsils taken out. What I don't believe is that there's an epidemic. In the early 80s, about 500,000 kids in America were thought to have ADHD. The current estimate is over 8 million. This is a boom for the drug companies. And I think what's going on here is that kids are living in the most intensely stimulating environment in the history of the earth. They deal with more information in a day than we dealt with in a year. Their minds are moving at 1,000 miles an hour. And we're penalizing them now for getting distracted. From what? You know, boring stuff. And I think rather than anesthetizing them, we should make the program more interesting.
And put them in music and put them in art programs. And Ken, our time's about gone, but I hope that people will read the book, because if they do, they'll understand that creativity is not some peripheral to our economy. It's fundamental to it. I want to thank you for writing it. I want our viewers to get a copy of this book from your bookstore, from Amazon.com. The author is Sir Ken Robinson. We want to have him back, have more discussion on the value of creativity. And if you're one of those people afraid about losing your job, think that something may happen to your economic situation, maybe a good time to look at what do you love doing. The book is the element. Thank you, Ken Robinson, for being with us. We'll be right back.
Listen again.
I've long believed that one of the most important things we need to be teaching our kids in school is music and art. And here's why. An education system that simply just transfers data from one brain to another is not an education system. It's a data download. We need real education. Joining me now is a person who understands something about it and probably the most gifted communicator on earth when it comes to helping to explain the value of creativity. Sir Ken Robinson, the author of the brand new book that I hope you'll read called The Element. Sir Ken Robinson joins me here today. Sir Ken, it's great to have you here. What a pleasure. Now, this book is a fascinating book into why creativity has an important impact on the economy. Mm-hmm. So tell me, in a time when people are losing their jobs, worried about the economy, why on earth should we be even discussing creativity and things of that nature?
Well, Mike, the world is moving so quickly now. Technology is changing everything. Populations are increasing. There's more competition. Globalization is taking away all the basic fundamentals of the success of the American economy hitherto. And truthfully, a nation that doesn't innovate will simply fall behind. And innovating in the 21st century means developing everybody's talents. It's a totally different game now.
Different than the old days of here. We need to learn these math tables and learn these scientific
Well, you need
formulas.
To learn those things too. This isn't to say that creativity means not learning things. It means learning things to a much higher level. But my big concern, really, and why I've written the book, is that in my experience, most people, most adults, have no idea what their real talents are. And their children don't know what their real talents are either. And I think one of the reasons for it is education. I give lots of stories in the book. You know, I'm from Liverpool.
Right.
And so are the Beatles, the popular music group.
You interviewed Paul McCartney for the book, in fact.
It's very funny you should mention.
I'm very jealous. Very jealous.
Well, Paul McCartney went to the school across the street from where I went to. I didn't know him then. But that school is now a school for performing arts. And I interviewed him for the book, and I asked him if he enjoyed music at school. And he said he hated it. In fact, he went through the whole of his education, and nobody thought he had any musical talent. Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
He does, doesn't he? They had, in the same music class at the same time, was George Harrison, the lead guitarist mm-hmm. of the said popular music group, the Beatles. And nobody thought he had any talent either. So this one music teacher had half the Beatles in his class. and he missed it. Now, this is my point, really, that often talent is buried deep. And unless you look for it, unless you really give the encouragement and the conditions for it to flourish, you don't discover it. And the book really is about that. It's about how, personally, if people don't discover their true talents, they never, I think, live a life that has real purpose and meaning. And secondly, for the success of the American economy, the global economy, it makes sense now that we should have an education system that really looks deep for people's genuine talents.
We're talking about getting to double digits in unemployment, first mm-hmm. time perhaps since the Great Depression that's happened. That may happen this year. If a person's about to lose their job, what would your advice be to them in terms of starting another career and moving on from that?
I think no matter what age they are, they should start to think hard about the things that have always excited them, about the things where they feel comfortable, the things that make their imagination work. In my experience, most people have that. You know, there's a sense that there's something they would have done if they could have done it, something that really made them feel most comfortable. A lot of people in my experience, a lot of adults, live their lives doing work they don't enjoy much, doing things that don't really turn them on. And they do it because they feel they have to or because they just drifted in that direction. I know from your own story, I mean, you discovered music at school.
Yes.
Theater. Didn't that help you become the person you are?
I would not be sitting here talking to you today had it not been for music and theater and debate and those things. Those were the things that turned me on. And I think there are so many kids. The dropout rate now is 1 in 3 kids in America. 1 in 3 leave school. They don't even finish. And it's not because they're dumb. It's because they're bored.
Well, I think that's true. You know, can I ask you how old you are, Mike?
I'm 53.
I can't believe that. You know,
if I was female, I would have slapped you.
But
I'm okay by telling you that.
But you're mentally slapping me. I can feel it. You know. Well, you know, most people, I'm 59. No, I'm not, 58. I know I don't look that, but I live in Los Angeles. You know, I've had work done.
Yeah.
What can I tell you about? But most people of my generation had their tonsils taken out. I don't know if you had your tonsils taken out.
Yes, I did.
May I ask the audience, how many of you had your tonsils taken out?
Ah.
A lot of tonsilless people up here.
A lot of tonsilless people.
Yes.
When were you last asked that, by the way? It doesn't come up socially, does it? Your Deirdre, you do have your tonsils. It doesn't come up. I've asked rooms full of people, maybe 2,000 people of the boomers, have they had their tonsils taken out? In the 50s and 60s, people routinely had their tonsils removed.
Yes, they did.
When I was a kid, you couldn't afford to clear your throat in public, or somebody would pounce on you and take your tonsils out. and probably adenoids as well, Laura. You know, people had whole body parts removed, whimsically. And some people did it voluntarily for the ice cream. Now, the reason I'm saying this is that nowadays, if you ask a room full of teenagers if they've had their tonsils taken out, mostly they haven't. This is only done now in critical cases, and it used to be routine. Now, this generation doesn't suffer from the plague of tonsillectomies. It turned out to be a false epidemic. What this generation suffers from is a new false plague of ADHD. Now, don't you agree?
Yes.
You know, now, don't mistake me. I'm not saying there's no such thing as ADHD. It's a genuine condition. Doctors agree on that. Some people need their tonsils taken out. What I don't believe is that there's an epidemic. In the early 80s, about 500,000 kids in America were thought to have ADHD. The current estimate is over 8 million. This is a boom for the drug companies. And I think what's going on here is that kids are living in the most intensely stimulating environment in the history of the earth. They deal with more information in a day than we dealt with in a year. Their minds are moving at 1,000 miles an hour. And we're penalizing them now for getting distracted. From what? You know, boring stuff. And I think rather than anesthetizing them, we should make the program more interesting.
And put them in music and put them in art programs. And Ken, our time's about gone, but I hope that people will read the book, because if they do, they'll understand that creativity is not some peripheral to our economy. It's fundamental to it. I want to thank you for writing it. I want our viewers to get a copy of this book from your bookstore, from Amazon.com. The author is Sir Ken Robinson. We want to have him back, have more discussion on the value of creativity. And if you're one of those people afraid about losing your job, think that something may happen to your economic situation, maybe a good time to look at what do you love doing. The book is the element. Thank you, Ken Robinson, for being with us. We'll be right back.
This is the end of Task 1. Task 2. You will hear part of a program. Read through the notes below and complete them by filling in the gaps according to what you hear. Gap 0 has been completed as an example. Now, read the notes.
From the big screen to the Broadway stage now, tonight the show that was the fastest-selling ticket in the history of London's West End opens on Broadway with its original cast. The play is called One Man, Two Governors. And as Jeff London reports, it relies on a style of comedy that began in Italy some 500 years ago.
If you weren't a college theater major, you can be forgiven for not knowing much about Commedia dell'arte, which is the Italian form Venetian playwright Carlo Goldoni used for his comedy, The Servant of Two Masters, in 1743. Contemporary playwright Richard Bean has adapted that play into One Man, Two Governors, and he says all you really need to know about Commedia is, well, it's funny.
Commedia dell'arte is a very physical comedy, and there's a lot of clowning in it, yeah. You won't find much irony in this play, you guys. You know, if you think this is going to be, oh, one of those very sophisticated British ironic comedies, no, we're a little bit more Benny Hill than Monty Python.
I've got two jobs. How did that happen? Oh, you got to concentrate, ain't ya? With two jobs. I mean, I can do it. As long as I don't get confused. But I do get confused easily.
Commedia dealt with stock characters. The clown, the saucy maid, the oppressive father, the shady lawyer. All of whom show up in One Man, Two Governors, albeit in British stereotypes. The play showcases the comic talents of James Corden, a British TV star, says Richard Bean.
The play is about stock characters and stereotypes quite deliberately. It's not a failing of the play that they're stereotypes. It's actually pretty much the point of the play. And James's character is a fat guy who's hungry. It's as simple as that. In the second half, he's a fat guy who's horny.
He likes his food, yeah.
Does he prefer eating or making love?
It's a tough one, that, isn't it? I don't know.
It's the most fun I've ever had with my clothes on, do you know what I mean?
Actor James Corden.
I've never heard noise like that in a theatre, like the noise that's generated in the audience from this play.
Part of the noise generated comes from Corden's direct interactions with audience members. Director Nicholas Heitner says just as Commedia dell'arte made use of improvisation, Bean's play has moments that allow for spontaneous mayhem.
One of the things that we do is a lot of audience participation. You should be warned, if you sit on the front row, you might be pulled up onto the stage.
And James Corden told me as he was preparing to go on for the 238th performance of the play and his fifth in New York.
I've never actually done the same show twice. I just have this great freedom, I guess, to really see how the night's panning out. You know, every night I never quite know what I'm going to say, you know.
One Man, Two Governors is set in Brighton in 1963. It features original songs in the pre-Beatles British pop style called skiffle, and all the actors do little solos with the onstage band during scene changes. Director Nicholas Heitner says Brighton was the perfect British equivalent for Venice, a place where disguised lovers hide out in The Servant of Two Masters.
Brighton is a seaside town on the south coast. A tourist town, it's where you go for a dirty weekend. It's always had a slightly shady criminal underworld. There are a lot of hotels, a lot of pubs, a lot of people walking along the promenade, courting each other. And exactly where you'd go if you were on the run from the law in the big city.
My rival in love, Roscoe Crabb, arrived from London today and is staying here.
Bizarre! Roscoe Crabb is the name of the chap I killed accidentally last Saturday evening, stabbing him three times in the chest with a knife I bought earlier.
The show's creators say very little has changed with the transatlantic crossing. Just language, which American audiences might find confusing, says director Nicholas Heitner.
We've come here genuinely, in all humility. This is what we find funny. If you find it funny, we're delighted. We think you'll find it funny because you find Fawlty Towers funny, but it is English humor.
And the very English One Man, Two Governors opens at the Music Box Theater on Broadway tonight.
Now, listen again.
From the big screen to the Broadway stage now, tonight the show that was the fastest-selling ticket in the history of London's West End opens on Broadway with its original cast. The play is called One Man, Two Governors. And as Jeff London reports, it relies on a style of comedy that began in Italy some 500 years ago.
If you weren't a college theater major, you can be forgiven for not knowing much about Commedia dell'arte, which is the Italian form Venetian playwright Carlo Goldoni used for his comedy, The Servant of Two Masters, in 1743. Contemporary playwright Richard Bean has adapted that play into One Man, Two Governors, and he says all you really need to know about Commedia is, well, it's funny.
Commedia dell'arte is a very physical comedy, and there's a lot of clowning in it, yeah. You won't find much irony in this play, you guys. You know, if you think this is going to be, oh, one of those very sophisticated British ironic comedies, no, we're a little bit more Benny Hill than Monty Python.
I've got two jobs. How did that happen? Oh, you got to concentrate, ain't ya? With two jobs. I mean, I can do it. As long as I don't get confused. But I do get confused easily.
Commedia dealt with stock characters. The clown, the saucy maid, the oppressive father, the shady lawyer. All of whom show up in One Man, Two Governors, albeit in British stereotypes. The play showcases the comic talents of James Corden, a British TV star, says Richard Bean.
The play is about stock characters and stereotypes, quite deliberately. It's not a failing of the play that they're stereotypes. It's actually pretty much the point of the play. And James's character is a fat guy who's hungry. It's as simple as that. In the second half, he's a fat guy who's horny.
He likes his food, yeah.
Does he prefer eating or making love?
It's a tough one, that, isn't it? I don't know.
It's the most fun I've ever had with my clothes on. Do you know what I mean?
Actor James Corden.
I've never heard noise like that in a theatre, like the noise that's generated in the audience from this play.
Part of the noise generated comes from Corden's direct interactions with audience members. Director Nicholas Heitner says just as Commedia dell'arte made use of improvisation, Bean's play has moments that allow for spontaneous mayhem.
One of the things that we do is a lot of audience participation. You should be warned, if you sit on the front row, you might be pulled up onto the stage.
And James Corden told me as he was preparing to go on for the 238th performance of the play and his fifth in New York.
I've never actually done the same show twice. I just have this great freedom, I guess, to really see how the night's panning out. You know, every night I never quite know what I'm going to say, you know.
One Man, Two Governors is set in Brighton in 1963. It features original songs in the pre-Beatles British pop style called skiffle, and all the actors do little solos with the onstage band during scene changes. Director Nicholas Heitner says Brighton was the perfect British equivalent for Venice, a place where disguised lovers hide out in The Servant of Two Masters.
Brighton is a seaside town on the south coast, a tourist town. It's where you go for a dirty weekend. It's always had a slightly shady criminal underworld. There are a lot of hotels, a lot of pubs, a lot of people walking along the promenade, courting each other. And exactly where you'd go if you were on the run from the law in the big city.
My rival in love, Roscoe Crabb, arrived from London today and is staying here.
Bizarre! Roscoe Crabb is the name of the chap I killed accidentally last Saturday evening, stabbing him three times in the chest with a knife I bought earlier.
The show's creators say very little has changed with the transatlantic crossing. Just language, which American audiences might find confusing, says director Nicholas Heitner.
We've come here genuinely, in all humility. This is what we find funny. If you find it funny, we're delighted. We think you'll find it funny because you find Fawlty Towers funny, but it is English humor.
And the very English One Man, Two Governors opens at the Music Box Theater on Broadway tonight.
This is the end of task two. Task three. You will listen to this task just once. You will hear some extracts. Read through the headings before listening. For each extract, choose the heading that best matches the information you have heard. Then, write the letter in the corresponding white box. There are two headings you will not need, and an introductory extract as an example. Now, read the headings. Example.
Well, he had an incredibly innovative life. He was creative. His experiences were ones at that moment in time which were, I think, quite astonishing. As we'll discover, he actually went to school, which was, I think, a major breakthrough at that time. His commitment in terms of creating the Braille system, which we'll explore, and the way in which he's inspired people since. So he actually changed the world for tens of thousands of people, and I think that's a great life.
Extract number one.
What I like about him is his ability to make decisions in the field and where you're beyond the complete control of circumstances. And I admire him immensely as a human being, because I think when we look back, we can play God, we can look back on history with the benefit of hindsight. He was the man on the field at the time. And we often ask the question, why didn't more Germans stand up to the Nazi thugs and the lunacy of the Third Reich? And here is a general who did. At least that's my understanding.
Extract number two.
My interest in Conan Doyle really began with, of course, Sherlock Holmes. I was brought up in London in the 1950s. My parents lived in a mansion flat in Baker Street. And as a child, I literally looked out of my bedroom window onto what was considered to be 221B Baker Street. So as a small boy, not only did I read all the Sherlock Holmes stories and fall in love with them, I felt I knew the man, and I think Conan Doyle is everything that I am not. But as the years go by, I think he is more and more what I would like to be. But then I was sent away to boarding school.
Extract number three.
First, try to imagine her, a small, rather plump woman, less than 5 feet tall. She dressed like Queen Victoria in kind of stiff, black, rustling silks. And yet she travelled to every far-flung corner of the world where almost nobody else had ever been. I think the travel writers who do endure are the ones who manage to kindle the imaginations of generation after generation after generation. And she was a wonderful writer and a wonderful reporter from the far-flung corners of the world. She brought a world that none of us will probably...
Extract number 4.
Well, I think she has a very strong claim to be the person more than any other who created the England we know and love. She has perhaps three great achievements to her credit, and these are quite astonishing achievements, particularly when, at the beginning of her reign, a very prominent Member of Parliament said that the realm was poorer in men, money, riches and wealth than he had ever known it. And in addition to all that, she was a compelling and perhaps even bewitching personality.
Extract number 5.
You know, history is written by the winners. And when Richard died on the field of Bosworth, a new dynasty was born. And that dynasty had to denigrate Richard, in a sense, because it had to show them as being the new choice. And then Shakespeare, of course, comes along again in the Tudor era. So we have the popular perception of Richard as the archetypal evil villain. And that play is based on Thomas More. So it's an amalgamation, I think, of those three very, very powerful things that really wrote Richard's story off completely.
Extract number 6.
She writes wonderfully. This is why she says she writes about her life. Because if I tell the story, I control the version. And because if I tell the story, I can get on with it. What I love about her is the most important thing, and I prize this highly, and my family always have, is being funny. And she can make anything funny, but she's also intensely practical. So here is a woman who's getting nominated for Oscars and BAFTAs and Golden Globes, but she'll still tell you.
Extract number 7.
She was extraordinary, and I knew her firsthand. And the first moment I met her, I was just totally in love with her. I was in love with her strength, her independence, that nonconformist curiosity. She was just absolutely insatiable when it came to knowing real people. She just could not get enough of other people's experience of their own lives. She wasn't interested in the Hollywood system she came from. She was interested in people. But I stood before a goddess, and it's simple as that.
This is the end of Task 3 and the end of the listening test.